This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show, airing on this station and on the web at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
The kind of discussion we're having is really very rare in U.S. media. Not because it's unimportant, but on the contrary, because it's so fundamental and important.
That's Norman Solomon. Join our conversation about Solomon's memoir, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. Later in the show, we sit down with novelist Valerie Martin. That's all right here. When I was a kid, I spent a lot of time anxiously surveying the sky overhead. I was looking for the plane that would drop the nuclear bomb that would end the world. Many mornings, I would wake up from nightmares of mushroom clouds exploding on the horizon. Like my guest, Norman Solomon, I responded by getting involved in the anti-war movement and by doing a lot of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. In his new memoir, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State, Solomon tears off the veil of optimism that infects our culture, he calls it the culture of hoax, to reveal the drive toward annihilation which it masks. It's a drive engineered by what he calls the exterminist state, and he says its imperative of domination and destruction continues no matter what party holds the White House or what nostrums of hope our political candidates pretend to offer. Solomon is an American journalist, media critic, and anti-war activist. A longtime associate of the media watch group FAIR, he's also the author of 10 books, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. It was recently made into a film by the Media Education Foundation. Norman Solomon, welcome to Writer's Voice. You start your book, Made Love, Got War, with talking about nuclear testing, the nuclear testing that the U.S. did after World War II. Why did you start there?
Well, literally, strontium 90 is in our bones from nuclear testing. By our, I mean people who were living during the nuclear testing, atmospheric testing era, which really we're talking 1945 to 1962 in terms of U.S. and Soviet testing. That's a lot of fallout radioactivity, and it was perpetrated on us with the argument that nuclear testing was necessary to make us safer. And, you know, literally and as a metaphor, I think, you know, the idea that somehow, you know, we can exist apart from politics is refuted by this reality, you know, huge nuclear explosions, fallout reaching, for instance, the pastures, into the milk of cows, into the supermarket, into our bodies, and strontium 90 into our bones. This is the way that even if we're not into politics, politics is into us.
And it had a profound effect on us, not only physically. I mean, I'm saying us, as I was born in 1949, so I'm sure I've got strontium 90 in my bones too. But also had a profound effect to us growing up as children emotionally.
Yeah, and this was perhaps the most insidious aspect of nuclear testing and the entire capital B bomb that overshadowed, I think, for the first time, a generation, no doubt. I mean, that is a huge difference between those who came of age before Hiroshima and afterwards. You know, life is never assured. Any of us, and this has always been the human condition, can die at any time. But the specter of the simultaneous death of everyone we know and all we don't know was a whole new matter. And as I say in the book, you know, this was a very celebrated push-button world, but it was also a push-the-button world. And we had that imagery that one or two people somewhere far away from us could make that decision to end our lives and all perhaps human life. That's you know, what does that do? I mean, the pretense is, well, it's no big deal, it doesn't affect us psychologically. I would doubt that.
You, in fact, say that, and I was actually surprised to read this because, and I completely agree with it, but you said before 1945, the generations that grew up before then felt that they had a future. They took the idea of a future for granted. Now, let's remember this was a time that saw World War I and World War II, and yet I do agree, I think they did think that, so much that they can't conceive of there not being a future, and yet for us, it's almost difficult to conceive of there being a future.
There's a distinction between a collective future and individual future. And so World War I took away a lot of individual futures, and not to in any way downplay how horrific that and other wars were, but the idea of a collective, of a humanity being under the gun, I mean, that really came with our generation. And I think it helps to explain the disconnect between our parents' generation and us. Part of the impact, too, was that we had a gap of communication, and there was a lot going on that I think was ineffable, the gap between our parents talking about a future, and then I think we felt, and it's not only for this reason, but the bomb was part of it, that they were fakers, they were phonies, they were putting forward a scenario for a future that might not exist.
Do you think that that has some connection with the counterculture, you know, the idea of, as you say, made love, got war? Well, the idea of making love, of tuning in, of dropping out, of kind of being open to a sensual world, to a world of pleasures, all this was part of the counterculture. Is that part of saying we better live now because we may not be living later?
I think that's part of it, and in the process, something that in the book I refer to as the culture of hoax really was a counterpoint to the counterculture, that we rebelled against, rejected the culture of hoax. We saw through it, whether it was this pretense of a social future that was debunked by what we knew loomed possibly ahead at any time, including nuclear holocaust, and also the pretenses. That's why in the book I spend a little bit of ink on the program Father Knows Best that was so popular. I know I loved it as a child. Perhaps none was more influential than that show. And it was all about, well, the title, not very subtle, Father Knows Best. It was an idyllic family, an idyllic projection of our present and our future. And in the book, I quote Billy Gray, who was the actor who played the only son on the program, named Bud on the show. And 17 years after the end of the filming of that show, which ran for 10 years on national television, he said, "It was a hoax. We were well-meaning, but that's all that program was a hoax." And so people were put forward to encounter these models to live by, these images of family reality, of American life, that didn't comport with their own experience necessarily, and actually was very phony. And I think there's a prototype there, whether it's the Father Knows Best program or the president speaking to the nation and saying, you know, our nuclear weapons will protect you, our armed forces are here to protect life. That was a hoax, that was phony, it was false, and the upsurge of creativity, opposition to the war in Vietnam, and the flowering of the counterculture, I think, were all direct responses to that falseness.
I was startled to see that you actually have a hero in the book that was one of my greatest heroes. That was from the book David and the Phoenix, which I actually just reread a couple of months ago. Talk about that, because the Phoenix there really talks about a different kind of education. And, of course, for a lot of us in the 60s, our first rebellion was an educational one.
It was a wonderful experience for me in writing this book to be able to go back and reread, which I've done periodically. I've probably read it six times since 1958. When, along with many other subscribers to the Weekly Reader Book Club, I received in the mail this wonderfully illustrated hardcover book called David and the Phoenix by Edward Ormondroyd. And it holds up so well in terms of, I would say, a work of art, a parable, and a character-driven story of this little boy who discovers a phoenix who takes him on the bird's back to all these wonderful adventures. As you say, from the outset, distinguishing between schooling and education, and it was the real-world encounter that the phoenix made possible that was so different than sitting in a classroom. And I think in the subsequent decade, I know I and many others rejected the idea that you learn only through, you know, the pedagogy and the institutional lockstep.
And for our listeners who have never even heard of the book or perhaps have never read it, just very briefly, give us the context of the book so they know what we're talking about in this idea of a different kind of education.
Yes, I think it very much came out of the zeitgeist. I mean, this is a book that, although it was written before Sputnik, it came out simultaneous with Sputnik and then was circulated widely through the Weekly Reader Children's Book Club the year after Sputnik. So it was in a cultural context with enormous emphasis on science, on education, on that sort of a empirical learning. And yet here was a book that raised all kinds of questions about the authority of science. In fact, the villain in the story is named the Scientist with a capital S, and he wants to kill the phoenix. And I go into this in the book about how the very concept of this scientist gunning for the phoenix was very much, I believe, a parable for what science was doing to life. I mean, when you think about what the phoenix is reborn. The phoenix is about continuity after 500 years, going into the pyre and out steps a young bird. And it was the scientist who didn't want to just understand the phoenix or life, but actually exterminate it. And can one think really of a better metaphor or poignant story than living in the nuclear age and being a child?
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with freelance columnist Norman Solomon about his book, Made Love, Got War, Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. And you talk, in fact, about, you use the term, the exterminist state. I'd like to read just a sentence from your book where you say, take away all the categories, left, right, moderate, pro and anti, this or that, and come back to the basic matter of the continuum. From one president to another, one commander-in-chief to another, that they've all been ready to demolish us in an instant. And you connect this, of course, to the mindset of science in terms of science in service of nihilism.
Yeah, I think nihilism is a good term for it, dressed up in a very star-spangled, we believe, we are patriotic, we have spiritual values, sort of vestments. It's all covering up, I think, a huge hollow, which is the space that is held by these weapons of mass destruction. And the net result, I think, has so much to do with a sort of a don't-go-there, no-go zone. The kind of discussion we're having is really very rare in U.S. media, not because it's unimportant, but on the contrary, because it's so fundamental and important. And there's something going on in our zeitgeist, in our culture, our political economy, media, and society. For decades and decades, the most important fundamental issues are often those least addressed.
Well, say more about that. For example,
A counterpoint would be global warming, which is kind of an exception to what I just said, because somehow, after a great deal of work that many people have done, global warming is acknowledged as a huge threat, and I think it's one of the two big ones, the other being nuclear weapons. And you look at the different treatment of the two, I think that global warming, while it's profound and must be addressed, it's difficult to blame very, very specific institutions. The problem tends to be diffuse, even though clearly we know corporate America and U.S. government policies are, you know, culpable for some of the global warming reality and upcoming threat. Nuclear weapons, on the other hand, though, go virtually unchallenged in terms of the U.S. arsenal. And so you have that distinction between one of the two threats now, because of the activism and research, is being addressed. The other, still, we're hardly talking about it publicly.
I see what you're saying, and I see where you're going, but I'm not sure that I agree. I think, in fact, in global warming, one can really criticize pretty basic institutions, but the discussion has not gone there.
Right.
In the same way that, you know, perhaps you can't talk about nuclear war without talking about those institutions, but you sure can't tackle global warming without having that kind of public discourse either.
Well, I would make a distinction between the deeper discourse and what is in the mass media. I mean, with nuclear weapons, we're not even there. It's not even mentioned. If you do a search for phrases like nuclear weapons compared to global warming, no doubt, global warming is all over the place. But I would definitely agree with you that when you get to the deeper causalities of global warming, there's less and less specificity in terms of the media discourse because it would become uncomfortable. It would be more difficult to greenwash from a company like General Motors or Ford if we get down to specifics.
And this really goes back to something that I think is an underlying, well, actually quite a prominent theme in your book, and that is the disconnect between reality and what you could almost call the enchantment of our public discourse. I mean, we just use the word nihilism, you know, the philosophy that worships death, but we've got nihilism with a smiley face. We have this kind, you talk about the optimism that Americans have, and yet that optimism, the other side of it is heartlessness and an inability to have any kind of compassion for people who don't look or act like ourselves. So I wonder if you could talk more about this disconnect.
Well, there's the optimism that Americans have or that they are told to have, and the gloss put over people. You know, Americans, as I quote Mark Shields, the pundit on the NewsHour with Jim Lehrer, Americans are the most optimistic people in the world. You know, well, that sounds like a description, but it's more like a prescription. You know, viewers are told how they're supposed to be or they're out of step. And the prescribed optimism, I think, is often not correlating to what people actually feel or even might express privately. That, I think, is an alienating sort of a dynamic. You know, if people are not optimistic, you know, don't be apologetic about it. And in fact, if we're not, I guess in Plato's terms, you know, chasing the shadows on the wall, if we're really going to get down, then let's do it. Let's be real and then work from there. The culture of claiming that, you know, hope is sort of a prerequisite for activism, I think that also is probably very shaky in many cases. You know, to me, activism is a human imperative to try to make the world better. It shouldn't hinge on whether I'm feeling hopeful or not. And I think a lot of that is tied in with what Robert J. Lifton has called psychic numbing, that so much of our culture, and as a human tendency as well, but accentuated by media and political pressures and atmospherics, we are numbed to feeling, you know, about suffering that's caused by wars that are financed in our names with our tax dollars and all the rest of it. When we're numbed, we are numbed from action. We become immobilized. And I think we have a numbing mass culture in this country to a large extent.
In fact, you also make reference to an article, an op-ed by the New York Times columnist Thomas Friedman that came out, I think, during the first Gulf War, in which he says, you know, give war a chance, heh, heh, heh.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit about that example and what it says about our media?
Well, Thomas Friedman recycled his purported witticism from one war to another. He used it in his column and on television. He did so during the bombing of Yugoslavia, which he was very enthusiastic about. He then used it years later in talking about publicly, writing about the bombing of Afghanistan, likewise very enthused in the fall of 2001. And I spend a couple pages on Thomas Friedman because I think that he's a sort of an archetype, often described as the most influential journalist in America right now, somebody who has all sorts of liberal reputation and yet uses some of the most simplistic formulations of language and concepts to justify not only corporate globalization, but also one war after another. And the callousness involved is really stunning when you go back and you look at his use of language, his enthusiasm for the slaughter, his blithe, not only acceptance, but cheerleading for bombing of a city like Belgrade. It's really, I think, a window into just how deeply the warfare state is embedded in our own consciousness and media.
So unpack this a little bit more for us. You just made mention this is rooted in our, you know, our military-industrial complex. But personally, what do you feel that allows people like Thomas Friedman to actually have this kind of callousness, that allows our culture to have that? What is that all about?
Well, you know, a more evasive answer on my part, and I'll try to address your very good question more directly, is I would say, you know, I do media analysis, not psychoanalysis. But I think we do need to try to understand as best we can those human dynamics. And, you know, people are all over the map psychologically, and they have very different and differing reactions to suffering and cruelty in the world. I think Thomas Friedman, being a journalist, has a lot of incentive, conscious or otherwise, to go along with the power structure, to be a little bit ahead of the curve, to be seen as iconoclastic or breaking new ground, but not go way out on a limb. And I do believe that living in a warfare state, it's really not good for one's career to challenge the precepts that underlie this just huge reliance on militarism, the psychology of it, spending $2 billion a day on the U.S. military. And it hasn't hurt his career to have this affect, which is, I think it is callous. I think it is sort of a objectifying of other human beings. It's a free spirit when it comes to let's you and them fight, a very sort of flippant enthusiasm for wars that he approves of, and unfortunately there have been many of those.
Yeah, and also the incredible distance, physical and psychological, that Americans feel towards others, Friedman being one of them. You have another, I'm going to make another quote from your book again. On page 27, you talk about something Lenny Bruce, a poem that Lenny Bruce wrote in the voice of Adolf Eichmann, Eichmann being the head of the Nazi program of the extermination of the Jews, who was tried and hung by Israel in 1961. So he's here, he's in a performance, and he's reciting lines from a poem from Thomas Merton.
Right.
And he says, "My defense, I was a soldier. I saw the end of a conscientious day's effort. I watched through the portholes. I saw every Jew burned and turned into soap. Do you people think yourselves better because you burned your enemies at long distance with missiles without ever seeing what you'd done to them?"
That's really at the core of what I've been trying to address. Not the most palatable of messages, to put it mildly. And so there is a very sort of downbeat mood that I think I've been trying to grapple with and engage with, because I think it's about realities that that are so formative of our society. And just because the light that is shined by the hype and the media and the rhetoric and the politics leaves those realities in the shadow, it doesn't mean that we don't live in those shadows, and they're there, and we can come to terms with them as best we can, or we can simply not even try. And, of course, I really feel that we should be talking about this, and we should be trying to move our politics and our culture and our discourse to more of a reality engagement rather than simply the, as you said, the smiley face stickers.
And the book is Made Love, Got War. And the author is Norman Solomon. He's my guest today on Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Well, that's something that the Cultural Revolution was supposed to do, was to get us closer to reality, whether we called that closer to the land or closer to our inner reality through drugs. You know, on the one hand, in your book, you do give credit to the Cultural Revolution for some very real changes in consciousness. But you also talk about how it was co-opted. You say the same drugs and technology adored as forces for enlightenment and liberation could and would be quite compatible with a warfare state. And then you go on to talk about how hippies were involved with the computer revolution.
Yeah, and also with, as part of the computer revolution, devising ways in Silicon Valley to better equip the U.S. military for being able to launch nuclear weapons. You know, you had that anomaly of people around Stanford doing LSD on the beach for their office parties and then instructing these officers of how to use the software to launch nuclear warheads. And I think that, you know, that sums up a lot of the contradictions. I certainly have and express in the writing a lot of ambivalence about the use of psychedelic drugs. On the one hand, really help people break through a lot of rigidity, a lot of acculturation that was doing them no good in terms of separating them from their own emotions, their own bodies. But at the same time, as I quote Jeff Nuttall, the author of the 1968 book, Bomb Culture, saying, these drugs were a good tactic against society, but a poor alternative to it. And you can't really build on drugs because the essence of human vision and capability is human. It's not a substance. It's not pharmacological in any way.
Well, you know, those are the limitations of the drugs. And yet sometimes I think of the fact that these were the folks who began the Internet, and the Internet has been a great liberatory force. So and has really torn down the barriers between people all over the world, and yet also has been responsible for many people living in a virtual reality and being even further away from actual reality.
Yeah.
So what are your thoughts on this kind of tension? I mean, we're here, the Internet is here, the technology is here. What are the ways that we can break through the limiting aspects, the ways in which these distance us from reality and nurture more of the ways of connection and responsiveness?
Well, I think that fundamentalism for any substance or technology is very hazardous, you know, whether it's, you know, LSD, and you know from reading the book, I quote Ken Kesey, who in the 60s, went to Stanford, was in front of a computer, and he said, hey, this is the next thing after acid. And there's something to that. You know, people look for a substance or a technology for liberation, and I don't think that there is such a thing as a techno fix or a drug fix for whatever ails us. This is ultimately a human task, and those can be tools, very profoundly useful tools, but I don't think that a soul was ever liberated by technology per se. I think that the scientific products, the R&D, the technologies are in a social context always, and it depends on what we do with that. So as I say, it's kind of the color of water, and it depends on what the set and setting, the surrounding, the uses, the attitudes, the values and priorities are in that situation. And I think it's up for grabs. I think the Internet has been wonderful in many ways, but it also, in some respects, I think, has had an effect of separating us from each other. The glass and the pixels will never substitute for being right next to a person, and there is a downside as well.
And you also say that there is a downside to, for example, the organic movement, where you say, well, for example, that Walmart is, you know, pushing for organic food. And I guess I'm wondering, are we forgetting that there may be ways to co-opt, or can one co-opt, in fact, the very kind of technologies that are being held by that kind of world we are struggling against?
Oh, I think it's all potentially co-optable, and often that's what happens, whether you're talking about marijuana and LSD or Peter Mack's drawings, as I point out, that style used by the Air Force to do recruiting by the early 1970s, the Internet, organic foods. I discovered that in the county where I live in California, very big on organic foods, there's a company based here, and it sells organic coffee in Fallujah and Baghdad on U.S. military bases. And so, you know, organic war, there you go. But what does that mean? What does that tangibly convey? And frankly, I'm part of this. I love organic food, but it's very easy to make a fetish out of it. And that doesn't really solve much for us. It's not a national solution, much less a global solution, to say I'm going to eat organic food.
And yet, on the other hand, I guess what I'm trying to say is maybe it's not, but it is in as much that organic becomes a wider way of eating and doing things, then people become more aware of the poisons that we're putting into our atmosphere and therefore more aware of the reality of what we're surrounding us ourselves with. So I guess I'm asking, can the co-optation go two ways? I mean, perhaps you're right that organic foods can be co-opted, but can they also be a worm within the heart of capitalism to actually move vast numbers of people to a different kinds of consciousness?
Well, I'm skeptical because as it was possible to use psychedelic drugs and go to war, or for that matter, as the title alludes to, Made Love, Got War, Make Love and Make War, it's also very possible to ingest and even celebrate organic foods in the process of furthering the interests and the destructiveness of the warfare state. And I think we don't need to speculate. That's happening around the country. The consumerism is widespread. And we tended to think, I certainly did, in the 60s and into the 70s, that these were the battle lines. On the one hand, the psychedelic drugs, the organic food, which has been around really for several decades, these sort of stylistic and substantive tendencies. On the other hand, were the war makers, the corporate ravaging forces. And I thought a good motif, a way to kind of pull that out into relief and shine a light on it, is the book The Greening of America. You know, the huge smash bestseller came out in 1971, and it was very much this notion that consciousness and organic food and back to the land and a loving attitude to cultural change was the only way to create social change. And the book, in retrospect, was just fundamentally wrong. And that's why I went back and read the book by the same author, Charles Reich, 25 years later, called Opposing the System, and he had sorted it out, I think, quite correctly by then. His book, Opposing the System, said, you know, of course we, the things we value, love, peace, connection, caring, nurturing, it's not about money. And yet, economic power has circumscribed our possibility to nurture exactly those qualities that we value.
Are you risking then that people kind of on the left channel themselves into this ultra pure place where nobody's listening to them? Or are there in fact ways to use some of this consciousness as a wedge to really penetrate to the deeper lessons, to a deeper consciousness of what's really going on?
Well, I think rather than a dualism, we can really integrate and, if you will, have a sort of a dialectical relationship. Women's liberation, sex roles in general, gay rights, the attention to nature. In so many ways, we need to keep reintegrating. So I think this is a sort of a cross-pollination, if you will, and I think we shouldn't polarize or juxtapose unduly these various tendencies because, as Gandhi would say, there are elements of truth in a lot of parts of the circle, and we need to find them and reintegrate them.
Finally, what to you is the most important thing that you feel you want to be doing now in terms of our discussion? What guides you?
Well, along with writing and speaking and trying to be part of a process to move in the directions that are needed that we've been talking about here today, I also am very specifically concerned about state power and the fact that the right wing has grabbed so much of governmental power and all branches of the federal government, so much of the capability to govern and the levers of governmental power. And so I would say that I'm really struck by the need to become more engaged with the electoral process. I am personally involved with Progressive Democrats of America, the organization. But the key point is that whether it's, you know, aldermen, city council, town councils, Congress, or president, we need to engage in the process that puts people in those positions, because like it or not, that will have a profound effect on the future, and we should be involved in that process.
That was Norman Solomon, and the book is Made Love, Got War: Close Encounters with America's Warfare State. In addition to his work with the organization FAIR, which stands for Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, Norman Solomon is the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He also has a weekly column, Media Beat. You can find links to all of those at our website, writersvoice.net. Stay tuned for a conversation with Valerie Martin about her latest novel, Trespass. Back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Most of us like to think of ourselves as open-minded, reasonably tolerant people. But what happens when we feel that what belongs to us is threatened? When we feel trespassed against by strangers, foreigners, the archetypal other? Do we respond by trespassing against those we fear? Valerie Martin examines those questions in her newest novel, Trespass. The book's protagonist, Chloe Dale, lives a comfortable life as an illustrator in upstate New York. Her husband, an academic on sabbatical, is working at home on his book about the Crusades. Her only child, Toby, has started his junior year at New York University. But Chloe is disturbed by a combination of developments: the looming war in Iraq, the poacher who roams the land behind her studio, and finally by her son Toby's new girlfriend, a Croatian refugee named Salome Drago. I caught up with Valerie Martin at Smith College this past fall when she spoke at a conference there. We sat down at the back of the auditorium to talk about her novel, Trespass. This is a novel that really seems to operate on several levels. One level is that of the story of a white upper middle class family. Father Brendan is a professor, mother Chloe is an illustrator. Toby, the son, is a student at NYU, and he gets involved with a fellow student, Salome, who came to the U.S. as a child from war-torn Croatia. On another level is a story of that war in Croatia, and a particular woman within that war, told as a story within a story. And then there's also a mystery about a trespasser on the rural Hudson Valley property of Toby's parents. Could you say, what are the thematic connections between these different levels of the story?
Well, I think the title, Trespass, covers all the different aspects of the characters and their relationship to each other. Chloe is an artist who, as you said, has a poacher on her land, and she feels that her land is being invaded, that the territory where she makes her art is being invaded by someone she learns is a foreigner. Her house is being invaded by her son's girlfriend, who turns out to also be quite a difficult foreigner and a refugee from a war, which, of course, all wars involve various border crossings and various trespassing by neighbors, especially the war in the former Yugoslavia, which was really brutal, and you had many situations in which families were torn apart because Croats and Serbs had intermarried. So there's that kind of trespass. And finally, there's the trespassed against us from the Lord's Prayer, the notion of trespass as some kind of sin, as something that you can lose your soul if you persist in, and that we are required, as if we happen to be Christians, which Chloe is not, to forgive those who trespass as we forgive those forgive our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. I can still remember that. And part of what happens to Chloe is that she is unable to do that, to forgive.
What drew you to this theme of trespass?
Well, it was pretty simple and straightforward. I did have a poacher on the land where I lived in Dutchess County in New York, and I did confront him one day and realized that he was a foreigner, and I found myself very upset about the fact that he was there and wanting to find ways to make him leave and feeling very territorial. And this was unusual for me, and I felt conflicted about it, and that's often a place to go and look for a novel, I find. The other thing was that as that was happening, I was vexed by the run-up to the war in Iraq. My family and I were very much against it and felt very powerless to do anything to stop it. And that's another motivation for me to write, which is when I feel powerless. And so between feeling conflicted and powerless, there was nothing to do but write a novel about war.
You say you felt conflicted about this trespasser. The character of the mother in this book, Chloe, really kind of, I think, expresses a lot of those prejudices, ideas of the foreigner. I found I was repelled by her, and I think some of that repulsion came from the fact that I could actually recognize some things that I didn't really like about myself in her. Could you talk about that?
Yes, well, you're very big to do that. Many people don't. They just hate her, you know, outright and say, well, she's manipulative and controlling. I think she's a complex person. I was interested in that one reviewer described her as the victim of a condition in which she has a liberal mind but doesn't have a liberal heart. But I think that in some ways her reaction is fairly natural, especially from mothers of sons. I find they often feel that there is no woman who's good enough for their son. And in this particular case, the young woman is quite threatening to her. She feels her son is much too young, which he is. He's only 21. She worries that the young woman will get pregnant, which straight away she does. So I think a lot of her reaction is, and this is kind of an interesting thing because it happens again and again and often results in war, when your worst expectations are fulfilled really quickly, and you have to keep lowering your expectations, this makes one feel very threatened.
What do you mean by that, lowering your expectations?
I guess it's kind of hard to describe, but it makes me think about the government, you know. First, I think I fear that the government is going to start this war, and then the Congress you know, authorizes the government to start the war, and so my expectations that the Congress will stand up and do what I want them to do, what I think is right, they are in some ways lowered. I know I can't depend on them. And so then I go to join peace marches, and I think, you know, there's going to be a million people, but in fact, there really aren't very many. And so I know I can't count on that. So that's what I mean, that they continually go down. Chloe wants her son to marry an interesting person, go to college, go to graduate school. She shortly realizes that he is going to be a father and have a child by someone she doesn't like. So that lowers some expectations. And then he leaves school. So things for her just keep getting worse and worse.
And you said she's a mother of a son. And yes, I think many mothers experience, especially she is a mother who's very overprotective, I think you can say, of her son. So many mothers do experience that sense that no one else can be quite as good as they are. But there's more than just that storyline. There really is the story of the foreigner there. Would she have felt the same way if this had been the kind of girl that came from the same kind of background that she, the mother, had?
Well, I think we do. In the book, there is some talk about her hostility to former girlfriends, and he has never had a girlfriend that she really liked. It does seem, at least to her husband, Brendan, that her reaction to Salome is the strongest reaction she's ever had to any girlfriend. So I don't know if this is a person who could ever be satisfied with her son's choices, and that really is part of a problem. It's part of what Salome says to him. Your mother doesn't trust you. She doesn't think you're capable of making your own decisions. And he rejects that, but in fact it's true.
I think that was some of the most difficult part for me. I think that's probably where I did see myself being the mother of a son. And I didn't want to like her for that. I mean, we have an idea of ourselves that we do trust our children. Could you say more about this issue of trust and how this comes into also the theme of trespass?
Well, I think we have to trust our children. And when they reach the age that Toby has reached, which is he is 21, he is an adult, you know, our obligation is to encourage them to do what they want to do. I guess a really great example of parents who did do that are the parents of John Walker Lind comes to mind. You know, he early on exhibited a desire to be a Muslim and to go to foreign places. He left home very early at 16. His parents really did support him in everything that he wanted to do. And, you know, the result was, I believe he's still in prison. And he was, in my mind, he was an innocent. He was too young to make the kinds of decisions he was making. I don't know if I had a son, what I would have done in their situation if I had a son who wanted to do what his son wanted to do sincerely and for all the right reasons. You know, that's the kind of, it's easy to say, yes, I will always support my child, but when they come home and want to do something that you really see as either dangerous or against the principles that you thought you were offering them, the values that you thought you had represented, then I think it's quite a different story.
Well, Valerie Martin, in your book, in your latest novel, Trespass, there is also a sense of danger that really surrounds so many of the events of the novel and the background, the backdrop of the novel. There's the danger of going into the war in Iraq. There's even, you have a scene in the novel of the demonstration on February 15th, where I remember it well. I was there with my son on that day, and the terror that I felt when we were hemmed in and not allowed to quote-unquote trespass on the streets.
The public street, yes. We had the same experience. I found myself in a cage in a public street, told that I had no right to be there. That was quite a disturbing event. Yeah, I think the sense of menace and threat in this book is something that a lot of Americans will identify with and should think about, because it's all come about, and it hasn't come about just because of 9/11. It's come about because of what happened after 9/11, in my view. I had a young Italian friend visiting recently, and she had not been in the country for several years. And she said, why do Americans all seem to be threatened, and why are they terrifying themselves so much? I mean, everything that's on television is about, you know, don't let the children walk to the corner, they could be abducted, you know, watch out, your house could burn. That they seem to be really preoccupied with their own safety. And I think that's true.
And here again, circling then back to Chloe and to Salome, it seems to me Chloe, the mother, she feels menace from this girl. And it was a long time. I was really trying to figure out in the novel, is the menace real or is it just her idea?
Well, I'm not here to settle that question. that's something that's raised for the reader quite purposefully, and you know they can draw their own judgments. Salome's a complex character, like everybody else. We never know her thoughts, and that's why it is quite possible that what Chloe fears, which is that she is interested in the house, not the boy, that it could be true. She's was a refugee, a survivor. She had to kind of take care of her family from the time she was 10 years old and take care of herself. So she has lots of reasons to be very interested in her own progress in the world. And her need for security is probably stronger than Toby's, maybe not stronger than Chloe's. And that's where they come head to head.
Is she in some way contaminated by... She's a war refugee from Croatia. She's come to this country as a child. Her father lives in Louisiana, the Oyster King of Louisiana. She has a brother who was, one understands in the book, was played a rather menacing role during the war himself. Is she also contaminated in the minds of the Americans here just simply because she was a victim of war?
Well, I think when people meet refugees, they always feel a little bit anxious. It's anxious-making I always feel anxious because I think, you know, there's probably some way, shape, or form in which my consuming is responsible for this person being a refugee. In the case of the war in Croatia, that wouldn't be true, or not entirely true. But I do think, yeah, Americans feel uncomfortable around immigrants and about, around refugees. They represent a, something that can't be controlled. They represent people who don't have a home and are adrift. And the notion is that if people are adrift, they could be dangerous.
So, so Chloe, you get into the mind of Chloe, but you don't get into the mind of Salome. Why did you play it like that? And say more about Salome as a character for you.
Well, for me, she in the book is the other. She represents that which we don't know too much about, and someone who could have motives that we can't penetrate. So I would not enter into her head because for all of the characters, she is the other. Toby's very jealous of her. Brendan likes her a little bit in spite of herself. He finds her appalling, but he doesn't feel threatened by her. Chloe does feel threatened by her. She is a real young woman. She does, though, occasionally say things, I think, especially when she describes how her family left Croatia and how she grew up in Louisiana. She is a real young woman with real needs, and she's rather courageous, and she's very stubborn and strong-minded and clear-headed. All of these qualities she got because she had to, under pressure. So she's both, I think she's both a kind of a symbol of the other, but she's also a real character that the other characters, the comfortable characters in the book, have to deal with.
There are a number of levels of allusions in the story. There's also the figure of the father, Brendan, who is seems to be a much less complicated personality, a more amiable guy. And he's a historian. He's doing a book on Frederick Barbarossa, who was the Holy Roman Emperor. And this emperor was someone who was involved in the Third Crusade, but also, I happen to know, I'm not sure you really go into it in the book, he also was a great lover of Islamic culture. And was, and so I wonder, is there a connection there?
Yeah, it's Frederick Hohenstaufen, Frederick II.
Oh, it's not Barbarossa?
I think he's a grandson of Barbarossa. I'm pretty sure that's right. Yes, he was very interested in Islam, and Brendan tells a story about him going to hear the Iman call and how the Sultan was insulted, a story that has survived for thousands of years. Gee, I'm losing track of your question.
Okay, so my question is, you know, here he is, he's doing a book, he's been doing a book forever about somebody who was involved with crusading and also loved Islam, or at least had a lot of respect for it. And it seems to me that that's the kind of subtlety of mind that we don't seem to have in our public discourse these days.
Yes, well, Frederick was quite an outrageous figure, and he was excommunicated by the Pope for his passion for Islam, but it is true that I think, in the Middle Ages, some lines were very clearly drawn. You knew who the infidel was, but of course you did have things like the Inquisition, which we're not quite there again. But there's so many similarities between, what people felt threatened by then to what people feel threatened by now. It really is as if things have come around full circle.
No real advance from the Dark Ages.
Yeah, no, not really.
And then there's the other story in this book, and that is a story, I know I don't want you to, and I'm sure you don't want to reveal too much of the plot, but there is another story within the story that takes place in a war. And I actually wonder if you'd be willing to read a paragraph from the book. And I have it right here.
Yeah, this is a voice that intrudes in the narrative, and for a long time in the novel, we don't know who it is. We know it's a woman, and we know she has been living through a war. If only I knew where I was, I thought, or if there was some way to know what people lived here, which side they were on. I wasn't sure any longer what country I was in. I understood that it didn't matter what I called it, because whatever I called it, it was a country at war. War is a country, that's what I learned. And it always looks the same. The citizens share a culture, which is the culture of trying to save their necks. The soldiers have another culture, the culture of creating havoc. Suspicion is the currency. The economics are despair. I hadn't grown up in this country. I wasn't used to it. I stood on the hill in the rain, afraid to move. The smoke from the chimney, the open door, tantalized me. It would be warm inside. There might be a kind old woman who would offer me food and dry clothes, or there might be a man with a gun sitting at a table, ready to shoot me. Tears sprang to my eyes. It turned out that I wanted to live. This seemed enormously sad to me. I set off into the field. It wasn't very wide, keeping out of view of the door. I came up on the side of the house. It was an old stone cottage, small, with thick walls, a tile roof, and high casement windows. I couldn't see in. I crept around in the back, pressed close to the wall. The rain was pouring down in sheets, making water spouts from the corners of the roof. That was the only sound. I crouched down, why I don't know, and crept to the edge of the open door. From there I could see part of the kitchen, a sink, a counter with onions in a basket. These onions made my mouth water. A sharp crack startled me, and I flattened myself against the wall. But then I recognized the sound. It was wood sputtering in the stove. I stepped away from the wall and into the open doorway.
It felt incredibly real to me, the scenes of this part of the book, the story within the story. And I just wonder, how did you manage to get that verisimilitude?
Well, I think what she says is true. All wars are the same. I read quite a bit by two writers, Slavinka Draculich and Dubravka Ugrasic. I'm not sure I pronounced those correctly. And they are two Croatian women who wrote both novels, stories, and essays and journalistic pieces during that war. And so they really gave me some sense of the physical detail that that they experienced and that they observed, the changes in daily life that made it so hard to bear. So that was very helpful to me in trying to describe it. But then I had also read a book about the war in Lebanon, and the similarities were, you know, if you read about Iraq, the similarities are just leap to your eyes. War is always the same.
Was it hard to write?
Yeah, some of those scenes were pretty hard to write, although I was consciously soft-pedaling it, because what I read about what happened in that war, which was in Europe, you know, and Europeans were all horrified when they actually kind of opened the lid on Bosnia and they found out what was going on there, that it was so brutal, just indescribable. And I didn't want to, somebody called it the pornography of violence. I didn't want to shock the reader as much as I had been shocked by some of the things I read. So even though what you read in my story is quite horrible, it's the least of it. It's sort of the tip of the iceberg.
My final question to you is, the review in the New York Times by Sue Halpern called the novel the best kind of moral fiction, the kind that interrogates morality itself. Do you agree with that? And could you comment on that idea of moral fiction?
Yeah, I really liked that line in that review. I didn't like everything else. But yeah, I like the notion that morality itself should be interrogated. You know, I read this thing that Doris Lessing wrote. It was in the paper this morning about whenever a writer hears the question, should writers, they know that they have entered this realm of political correctness where they're supposed to be something that all writers should do and every writer should know it. But she doesn't agree that that's the case. And I think she's right. But I do try to engage in questions that have some moral content or some bearing on my own effort to understand what it would be to live a moral life and to live ethically. One of the things I, of course, and I think many liberals, if I can use that word, feel is that, you know, I know what's right and I know what should be done, but it's very hard to change my life, which is a comfortable one. And so in many ways, when things go wrong in the world, such as the beginning of the war in Iraq, I feel personally implicated. I feel that I am in some ways responsible for that happening because of the way I live. And, you know, that if liberals want the world they say they want, they're going to have to give up a lot, and which is sort of what happens to Chloe. So I guess in that sense, I think of it as an interrogation of morality itself.
In addition to Trespass, Martin is the author of Property, which won the prestigious Orange Prize in 2003, and of Mary Riley, among other novels and short stories. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we talk with Pamela Thompson about her wonderful debut novel, Every Past Thing. Find out more about Writer's Voice and upcoming authors at our newly designed website at writersvoice.net. You can leave your comments there and listen to or download past shows. Thanks to Michael Pollitt for his invaluable assistance. And thanks to you for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.